The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one, because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined by Robert Bryce, who is an energy writer, and some people call him the Joe Rogan of energy journalism. And Robert has produced a docuseries called Juice, Power, Politics and the Grid, which is a very interesting look at America's energy network and the politics that guides it, which is available for free on YouTube, and I would advise all Americano listeners to have a look at it. Robert, give us a little bit of background into Juice, why you did it, what's the driving force behind it, and so on.
Sure. Well, thanks. Great to be back with you, Freddie. Always a pleasure to be back on the Americana podcast, and great to see you in London a few months ago. So yes, the genesis of this project, I made a documentary with my colleague Tyson Culver, which we released in 2019, called Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. And I thought I was done making documentaries. And then 3 years ago, we were both blacked out here in Austin at our respective homes due to Winter Storm Uri. And then in the aftermath of that Texas blackout, we learned that, in fact, the entire Texas grid, the ERCOT grid as it's known, came within 4 or 5 minutes of complete collapse. And had that happened, we would have seen tens of thousands of people die. So that event really catalyzed us to think, well, we need to do something about this. We need to follow up on this and understand why our, you know, first, the importance of the electric grid, second, why it's being fragilized, and third, what we need to do to fix it. And while we do have a kind of, I live in Texas in Austin, we do have an America focus, we really do take this as a global look at electricity and the fragilization of electric grids. And it's clearly happening in Europe, I mean, and in Britain in particular. I mean, look at your electricity prices. Look at the deindustrialization of all of Europe because of these misguided policies of chasing weather-dependent forms of generation, wind and solar. And this is just bad policy. And so we see this, in fact, all over the world. And we're, our goal is to really change the conversation around electricity and the electric grid and make people understand what is happening and why this is so dangerous.
Well, it seems very odd to us non-Americans that America's domestic grid should be so fragile because, of course, America is an energy superpower. And in fact, you know, there was a bit of controversy last week because John Kerry lectured us Brits again about, you know, not drilling and so on. And a lot of Brits thought, well, that's very easy for America to say, you've done a lot of drilling. So could you address that for us? Well, I mean, why is America's own grid so fragile when seemingly you're abundant and you have done a fair amount of drilling?
Well, that's a great question. And there, no, we'll have to keep this pretty short, right? How long do you have? But the U.S. grid is unique in many, many ways. First, it's that it's so diffused, right? The U.S. has the most diffused ownership of any electric grid in the world, and that there's no second place. There are something like 3,000 different electricity providers in America. We have 800 and some odd electric co-ops, most of them in rural America. We have over 2,000 community-owned electric utilities. I live in Austin, Texas, so the city owns its own utility. Then you have about 180 or so investor-owned utilities, such as Duke and other big entities like that, Dominion. And then you have the government-owned enterprises like Tennessee Valley Authority and Bonneville Power Authority. So it's a very diffused ownership. So no one ultimately, and this is one of the key points we make in the docuseries, and by the way, it's juicetheseries.com. Juice the series. Did I mention juicetheseries.com? I hope I mentioned juicetheseries.com.
Keep doing it, yeah.
This is one of the key issues, is that there is no one responsible for the reliability of the grid. And that was what we found out in ERCOT here in Texas afterward, was, well, oh, it's the market. Well, the market failed. Well, who made the market? Well, it was made by a bunch of lawyers and in the image of Enron. So this is something that applies to Britain as well. Remember, you know, my first book, I've written six books. My first book was on Enron. It came out now 22 years ago. Enron successfully deployed this idea of deregulation or restructuring in Britain first under the Thatcher administration. Then it went to California, and then it came to Texas. So this history of the commodification of electricity is not just a Texas story. It's an international story, and it goes back in many ways back to the days of Enron.
Well, I suppose one thing we think about a lot when you talk about Enron and stuff is deregulation and this idea that energy is a national security matter.
Yeah.
And therefore, even in a free market country, you have to have oversight, supervision, and provision at a federal level, at a national government level.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a really key point, Freddie, is that one of the reasons why there was so much agreement on this idea of deregulation in California, in Texas, in Britain was the conservatives could say, oh, see, we're going to let the market work. And the liberals, you know, the solar and wind promoters could say, well, see, we'll let the market work and then we'll allow all these low-cost wind and solar assets into the grid as well. So it became this thing where they could both buy in. But again, the problem was this misunderstanding of the nature of electricity. It is not a commodity. It's a service. And for nearly the entire history of the electric business, from the days of Edison and Insull down, you know, since then, it's been viewed as a natural monopoly in which you have strong government oversight, where the government is looking over the shoulder of the utility, and the utility owned everything from the power plant to the meter at your home, and they were responsible. But now we've lost sense of that sensibility about that chain of command, that chain of responsibility. And it's going to be very difficult to bring back that proper level of regulation to assure reliability.
Tomorrow is Super Tuesday, and a lot of minds are beginning to turn towards the election in November. The Biden administration has been criticized a lot for not taking advantage of the seeming energy independence that America was reaching. Certainly Donald Trump criticizes a lot for that. Do you think energy will be one of the reasons if Joe Biden loses? Do you think it will be energy policy will be part of that?
Well, it might just be Biden's lack of energy himself. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, he is a low energy candidate. And, you know, to be clear, just, you know, my read of the politics in America, and I'm not a partisan. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm disgusted. I'm totally disgusted. I don't hold a brief for either party. And I don't want to vote for and will not vote for Biden or Trump. I'll put your name in, Freddie. I'll have you the write-in candidate here. You might just be the president of the United States. Who knows? But Biden, I mean, he's just not an appealing candidate because his personal energy is so low. Now, I made that underscore that because it's very clear the electorate is looking at Biden and saying he's too old. And he shows that in nearly every public appearance. He's just simply too old. He's not fit for the job. But it's also clear that his energy policies, I mean, this is the most anti-hydrocarbon administration in American history. And there's kind of, it's interesting to say that because despite the anti-hydrocarbon policies, oil and gas production in the United States is at record levels. I mean, it's never been this high. In fact, the U.S. is producing more oil and gas than any country in the history of history. Mm. So the oil and gas industry is succeeding despite Biden. But he's also made a lot of very political decisions, including this pause on LNG exports, which hurts Europe. And it is, I think it's just a boneheaded move at the end of January. But it was clearly a move by the Biden crowd and his funders to exert their authority and show, oh, see, we're going to bow and genuflect in the direction of climate change. When it's very clear that in polling data that the overwhelming majority of the public does not view climate change as the most important issue. But it is for a very select group of high-dollar Democratic funders. And so that's why he did what he did with the LNG move. And I wrote about it just recently on my Substack, robertbrice.substack.com. I called it Dialing for Anti-LNG Dollars, and that's just what he did.
Well, I read that Substack, and it was fascinating, as much for the questions that it threw up as anything else, because you talk about this sort of dark money behind the kind of anti-LNG move. So right. Just for listeners who don't know, America should be plugging an enormous gap in the global market since the Ukraine war with its LNG exports. It's a massive exporter right. of LNG. I believe in Texas, all the facilities are being geared up to make America a sort of LNG superpower. And yet the Biden administration in January announced a pause in LNG exports, which really seems to go against its obvious American national interests. And why would they do this? Obviously, there's the environmental reason, which they cite, but that is a odd reason because LNG is a relatively clean form of energy. And you point towards very large scale funding of groups that lobby against or have lobbied against LNG. And do you think this might be coming from China or Qatar, which is obviously an LNG supporter? Have you got any direct evidence of that, that they're doing that? And in which case, is this not a huge scandal?
Well, your last question first. I don't have any evidence of, you know, Qatari money or Chinese money behind this. I mean, now I will add, though, that it's very clear that the anti-fracking efforts that were in Europe, and in fact, some in the U.S., had Russian money. There's no doubt about that. And this is now several years ago, but that has been shown by several different investigations. But I think the other key point here, Freddie, as you say, is that now with Russian gas, and in 2019, Russian gas, the International Energy Agency, I just presented this slide last week in Washington. In 2017, I think, or 2019, Russian gas amounted to 47% of all the nat gas used in Europe. And last year, at the end of last year, it was 13%. Mm. So forget the issues of, you know, just to set them aside. We won't say we'll forget them, but set aside any discussions about climate change or coal or anything else. The reality is that Europe needs those U.S. molecules. Europe needs the U.S. to step up and provide more natural gas into their market because of that Russian gas going away. Now, of course, could other countries step in and fill that gap? Well, of course, the Australians, the Qataris, the Nigerians, the Russians. But it just seems to me this is such a very obvious power move by the big democratic billionaire climate funders that they're saying, we're going to flex our muscle here, and this is something we can do, and therefore we're going to do it. And the most cynical part of this, Freddie, is talking with people I know in the energy sector, is that the Biden crowd is going to some of the energy companies saying, oh, don't worry. You know, we know this is just pause. We know it just doesn't look good, but, you know, just don't worry about it. You know, everything's going to be okay. So it's a very cynical move. I mean, just by any calculation, incredibly cynical.
But it's, again, it's cynical but wrongheaded because, I mean, I remember I interviewed Dmitry Firtash in 2022. Dmitry Firtash is a Ukrainian energy oligarch, and he was quite conspiracy theorist about what was going on in America. And he thought that really America was driving this war because it wanted its LNG exports to be viable in Europe, for the price of gas to go up so that LNG was viable in Europe. And, you know, that may be conspiracy theories, it may be overly anti-American, but you could see that there could be some truth, some logic behind it. And yet this move from the Biden administration would go completely against that and suggest that America would rather shoot itself in the foot on energy for environmentalist grounds that are spurious, perhaps.
Well, you know, I can't necessarily speak to any of that. I mean, you know, I'm the last one to ask about conspiracy theories. I think Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. So, you know, I don't believe John Kennedy was killed by the CIA. So I'm the wrong one to ask. But I think ultimately the punchline of what we're seeing now, whether it's the LNG exports into Europe or whether it's energy security more broadly in Europe or what we're seeing here in the United States in terms of the security of the electric grid, ultimately it's the line that I use all the time, which is energy security is national security. And what we're seeing in Germany in terms of their electric grid, what are they doing? Well, they shuttered their nuclear plants. And so what are they doing now? They're reopening their lignite plants. So, you know, ultimately what Germany is doing for all of this talk about the energy vendor and the rest of it, practical energy politics are showing that they will do whatever they have to do to make sure that they have affordable electricity and reliable electricity. And Germany is just an obvious example of this. But I think it's all across Europe, and we were in Europe as well. And I think one of the other points we make in the docuseries, juicetheseries.com, is this comeback for nuclear energy is likely to be ignited first in Eastern Europe because they're more motivated to do it, right? That they don't have Russian gas now. And so there's much more reason for them to be adopting new nuclear because of the lack of Russian gas, and also the fact that in Europe you pay, you know, four or five times as much for natural gas as we do here in the U.S. So a number of factors, but all coming back to energy security, are helping drive this different approach now to energy in Europe in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war.
You said that you would never vote for Trump, but what do you make of Trump's energy policies in comparison to Joe Biden? I know you're keen on nuclear power, and you see it as the only answer, I think, from our previous discussions. What do you think of Trump's approach to nuclear power? What do you think of his promise that he will drill on day one? He will be a dictator for drilling.
Yeah. look, the president has significant power. Let's be clear in terms of political power and what they can do in terms of rulemaking and executive orders and so on. And the Biden administration has clearly done that. And they've used the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to push through rules that could cripple, in many cases, some of the electric utilities in the United States. And now this is going to be a battle in the courts for a long time. But I also think it's clear that, you know, I've thought about this a lot. If Trump wins, okay, well, and he may well win. I mean, some of the polls indicate that he's beating Biden in nearly all the battleground states. And I had Peter Zion on my podcast the other day, and he's predicting Biden wins in a walk. Well, I don't think that's true. I think the election is going to be close, and it's going to be messy, because it always is close and messy. But if Trump wins, what will happen? Well, okay, he may be able to grease the skids a little bit for oil and gas production, and he may be able to accelerate somewhat the development of nuclear power in the United States. But let's be clear, the U.S. doesn't have there's not a big need to push for new nuclear in the U.S. because natural gas here is so cheap. The latest price, I think, is $1.60 per million BTUs. I mean, it's almost free. Hmm. So the other thing about Trump to remember is that if he wins, all of these NGOs, these climate NGOs, are going to be raising incredible amounts of money to push their agendas at the local and state levels and continue their lawfare that is going to be funded by Michael Bloomberg and his Beyond Carbon campaign. All of that is going to continue regardless of who's in the White House.
Mm. What does Michael Bloomberg think about nuclear power? Because as you've said before, if you want to get beyond carbon, nuclear power is perhaps the only way to do it.
I don't know what Bloomberg has, you know, when he was mayor of New York, I think he made some positive statements about nuclear, but now his Bloomberg philanthropies have just, they gave this Beyond Carbon campaign, which is a radical group, $500 million. Mm. And their effort is to close down every coal plant in America and half of the gas plants. Freddie, this is a more radical agenda is hard to conjure. I mean, they want to shut down 40% of all the electric generation in America and do so in 5 years. I said this in Washington last week. If a terrorist organization had come to the United States and said, this is our plan, we're going to shut down 40% of the electric grid in the U.S. in 5 years, it would be viewed as a national security threat. Mm. But because it's Michael Bloomberg, it's just like, oh, well, he's a rich guy and, you know, well, climate change and the rest of it. Well, okay, you can say that, but we have to be very clear about what the impact here will be. So I'm pro-nuclear. I'm adamantly pro-nuclear. I've been saying the same thing for more than 15 years, natural gas to nuclear. But we have to be very sober about the impact that nuclear can have in America and over what time frame. And it's the nuclear sector in the U.S. didn't wither in a day or two or a year or two. It happened over decades. Making it come back and to thrive again will take decades.
Well, it seems such a powerful argument. Short of, you make the point that presidents can only do so much and they'll create backlash and so on. How do you win the argument then? I mean, aside from through the media and public debate, which can be an even slower process than through politics.
Well, I'm very encouraged. I mean, you know, as I say, I'm sober about this, and I really am. I'm very sober. I study the numbers. This is what I do. It's where I live, and spreadsheets and so on, and thinking about what, you know, what is happening and what can happen and the scale of our energy and power consumption. But I see a change in the conversation. I see a younger cadre of pro-nuclear activists coming up. In the docuseries, one of the main characters is a Dr. Chris Kiefer, who's an emergency room physician from Toronto, who's had remarkable success in reviving and catalyzing a new pro-nuclear movement in Canada, to the extent that now I would argue Canada, I'd say very definitively, it's clear Canada is going to lead the global renaissance in the West of new nuclear energy. They're going to double the size of the Bruce Power Station, which is already the biggest nuclear plant in the world. They're refurbishing nuclear plants at the Darlington Station, and the other one begins with a P, it's escaping my memory. They're building small modular reactors. I mean, Canada and Ontario Power Generation is really leading the world now. And it's been remarkable. And a lot of that has been catalyzed and is due credit to Dr. Chris Kiefer, who's, I guess he'd be late 30s, early 40s, but an impressive character. And so I see the conversation changing. And it's not just changing in the United States, it's changing around the world. Canada is going to lead, but also Poland, Romania, Slovakia, probably, or Bulgaria. They're going to build new nuclear and they're going to get with it right quick.
You mentioned small modular reactors there, and that's often been the hope with nuclear, is that technology will make it so obvious every town could run on one small modular nuclear reactor and so on. Again, why hasn't there been more progress with that argument? Why hasn't there been more progress with small modular reactors?
Well, I think there has been progress, Freddie, and it's one of the points we talk about in the film, in the docuseries, rather, that these are promising designs, right? Rather than build a 1 gigawatt size reactor of 1,000 megawatts, we would build ones that are, you know, 100 megawatts or 200 megawatts or even smaller. So there's no shortage of good designs for these SMRs, as they're known, whether they're gas-cooled reactors or sodium, you know, molten salt-cooled reactors, or even light water reactors, which are simply shrunk-down versions of what we're using now in the main here in the United States and in Western Europe. So there's no shortage of designs that have merit. What there is a shortage of the capital and the regulatory environment to deploy them at scale. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States is a key barrier. I mean, it's a very important agency. NuScale Power, one of the companies that had its project approved, its reactor design approved, took them 6 years and $500 million. I mean, you just can't make a business case with that kind of delay and that amount of capital. So we need expedited regulatory approval. We need to, you know, build up our supply chains, the labor force. All of these things have to happen. The fuel. U.S. used to be the biggest supplier of uranium oxide globally, and now we import essentially all of our enriched uranium for nuclear reactors. So there are a lot of things that have to come together, regardless whether it's the small modular reactor size or the gigawatt scale reactors, to make nuclear great again.
I talked about small modular reactors there as though it's high tech, but I suppose it isn't really, because am I right in thinking a nuclear submarine, which we've had for a long time, they essentially are small modular reactors.
Sure.
And so what is the technology that is going to change? I mean, we could talk about nuclear fusion, but I think the last time we talked about this, you're relatively, not skeptical, but you're not too overexcited about that changing anything anytime soon. What is it in nuclear technology that could make the need for change so obvious?
Well, the technology, I mean, if we're going to think about, okay, so if I were king, or if I had the ability to push one sector of the nuclear area to more than any other, it would be nuclear power ships. So you think our first film, Juice, How Electricity Explains the World, it featured, we went to Beirut in Lebanon. And of course, this was before now the troubles in Gaza and the rest of it. But Lebanon still was very unstable, and it had always been unstable, right? It's a proxy state for the Iranians. And, you know, every spook in the world at one time or another goes through Beirut. But the Lebanese grid is so fragile that they had power ships offshore in north of Beirut and south of Beirut, and they were Turkish power ships. They were just these big ships that were right off the coast. They were moored, and then they were connected to the Lebanese power grid, and they were running on heavy fuel oil. And each of them was producing something like 200 megawatts. Well, imagine if you had nuclear power ships. Instead of having big reciprocating engines providing that power, you had nuclear reactors. Well, in fact, Rosatom, the Russian company, has done that with a nuclear power ship that's been deployed in Siberia. And they're using, what, if I recalled correctly, reactors that they've been using on their nuclear icebreakers. So imagine if you had nuclear power ships deployed. Remember, most of the world's population lives in coastal areas, so that you could deploy these nuclear power ships to the coast of Africa, to the coast of South America, to the coast of South Asia. You know, it'd be a revolution, right? So some of the companies that are designing this, there's one called Thorcon. They're developing a thorium-fueled reactor, and they're hoping to deploy it in Indonesia. Well, again, Indonesia would be a perfect place because it's an archipelago. You know, you have a lot of small islands. Well, a nuclear power ship there would be an ideal solution. So I think in terms of, and I've written about this on my Substack, robertbryce.substack.com, that shipyards could be the place where, if you think about the ability to fabricate these types of designs and do them at scale, shipyards would be the obvious place to make it happen.
And forgive my ignorance. So these power ships, there are wires connecting the energy they produce to the mainland.
Sure. The nuclear power ship, it's in Pivek in Siberia. Again, they just, the Russians just floated it up there. And then they just, you know, it's like we saw in Beirut or just outside of Beirut. You just have the power grid. You have these transmission lines that just connect directly to the ship that's sitting in the ocean. I mean, it's not a complicated process. And so, I mean, you could put those cables in the water as well if you wanted to, but obviously much easier to do it overhead. But if you really want to see a change in the world in terms of nuclear deployment and nuclear capacity deployed at scale, you do it with nuclear power ships because you could fabricate them in shipyards and do it very quickly.
Short of a great eureka moment among the elites everywhere in the West and Europe and America and so on, what do you think is the best way forward in terms of getting our politicians to think outside of the green agenda, which can be quite, well, it's very inventive in some ways and very innovative in other ways. It can be quite suffocating to coming up with realistic solutions for our energy problems?
Well, it's an interesting question, Freddie. We've got to be very sober about our electric grid and the importance of it. And that's really the purpose of this docuseries, Juice, Power, Politics, and the Grid. We wanted to spotlight the importance of the electric grid, understand why it's being undermined, why it's being fragilized, and what we need to do to fix it. So when I think about the idea of climate change, because I'm asked about this all the time, well, what's my view on climate change? Well, climate change is a concern. It's not our only concern. We have to balance whatever action we take on climate against all the other things these other needs in society. When it comes to energy and power, it's making sure we have energy and power systems that are affordable, reliable, and resilient. And affordability being the first one, because what I see here in the United States, particularly in states like California, electricity prices are skyrocketing because there's no understanding of the need for affordability. And instead, it's this headlong effort toward decarbonization that in many cases isn't succeeding, but they are succeeding in driving up prices. So you're seeing something similar in Britain and across Europe, where your energy and power costs are just soaring and you're not really making meaningful reductions in carbon. So it requires sobriety. I mean, if there's any one word that, you know, in how I would counsel policymakers and people to think about these things, we got to be dead sober about what we're doing here.
Mm. Robert Bryce, it's always a pleasure to have you on Americano. Please do come on again, and congratulations on the new series.
Thank you very kindly, Freddie. Did I mention juicetheseries.com?
You may have touched on it, but let's mention it again. juicetheseries.com, and you can catch it on YouTube. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks a million, Freddie.
That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Ferroz, and urge you to leave a generous, kind, and warm-hearted review of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.